Welcome to Just Plain Wrong, the podcast where three Mennonite librarians discuss depictions of Amish, Mennonites, and other plain groups in popular culture. I'm Abby, your moderator for this episode, and with me is my co-host, Aaron. Tilly did email us to say hello from Ecuador today, just prior to recording, so we can assure you she is alive and well. This week is our first guest interview for season six, and it is with historian Steve Nolte. So as a little bit of background, Steve is a professor of history and Anabaptist studies at Elizabethtown College and director and senior scholar at the college's Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies. Steve has written or co-written 14 books related to Amish, Mennonites, and Pennsylvania German groups, aka he should really be the one doing this podcast, not us. Before moving to Elizabethtown, Steve was a professor of history for many years at Goshen College, where I had him as a professor, and Aaron had the great privilege of co-teaching a course with him, and he was a frequent visitor to the good library. So, Steve, we are so excited to have you here. Anything to add or, I guess, subtract from that introduction?
No, not necessarily. I also had Tilly as a student, so just include her as well. So
yes,
you were both history majors, and yes, Aaron, did you and I teach two classes or just one? Things are kind of fuzzy in my mind. I think we did two sections, but now I can't remember exactly.
One for sure. I don't remember if there was a second year.
Right. It all kind of runs together at this point.
Thinking, it does.
Yeah.
Well, just as a note to our listeners, this is our first interview episode that we'll be airing. So along with some actual questions relevant to Steve's work, we have a few questions that we will be asking all of our guests for fun / important sociological research purposes. That includes this first question, which is, Steve, in your world, what is a haystack?
Okay, I think I know where this question is going. So I have, can I give you two answers? Or is that just sort of a college professor way of complicating things? So I think of it, when I think of a haystack, what first comes to mind is a craft, a skill that apparently my great-great-grandfather had this skill, which is to be able to stack hay and straw outdoors in such a way that it naturally sheds water. You didn't have to have it in the barn, but the bulk of the hay actually stayed dry. And so that's, to me, that's a haystack. However, having lived for a time in Northern Indiana, a haystack also evokes the, how should I say? It's sort of the Mennonite white people taco night phenomenon. Yes. Which is that it basically it's like a taco salad, but if you called it that, that would be a little too, I don't know, it would suggest maybe you were using, I don't know, it sounds kind of risky when you say even something like taco salad, maybe you're using a seasoning other than salt or ketchup. And so we give it a name of like haystack, which sounds very safe. So I think a haystack now, I think of it as a meal that is pretty bland, but yeah, has that name to kind of make it seem not so scary.
Well, and I think you would also, I would say that the two definitions might also have some slight visual connections in that, just like, you know, I think you said your grandfather would have known the art of carefully placing hay to shed water. There's a similar art that takes place when forming a haystack dinner in that, you know, you have to mound your plate in such a way that none of the toppings fall off and that, you know, the nacho cheese when applied on top doesn't drip off the edges. So I think you may have found some strong, some strong connections between those two.
I think that's right.
So did you not eat, you didn't have haystacks growing up? It was just, you just encountered them in Northern Indiana.
I encountered them the first time after I moved to Northern Indiana, and I thought it was a little odd and actually a little deceptive. I said, why don't we just call this a taco salad? But yeah.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So our next question is, what do you bring to a potluck?
That's a good question. So currently, the church we attend is often a little prescribed. Like, you know, last names, you know, A to J, whatever. So it's not necessarily a choice. But at one point, this goes back, you know, I don't know, many years, however many years, living in Goshen, I was sort of in a rut where there was a particular kind of chocolate bundt cake that I would take. But I haven't now for quite a while. But that was, I do remember there were a few years where that was sort of my go-to thing. Yeah.
Nice. Nice.
All right. And then our sort of last question along these lines is, what is it that you race to the front of the potluck line to get, to make sure that you get?
It would be deviled eggs, because they are too much work to make myself, but I like to eat them. So if someone brings them, I eat them.
Solid choice. All right. So to segue from those, we're going to, and a little bit also coming in from the introduction, just starting off with, how would you describe your personal background with Mennonites or Anabaptism?
Yeah, so I was born into a Mennonite family. So I was raised in a Mennonite home. If we kind of go back further in terms of ancestry and genealogy and that sort of thing, my ancestors, as far as I know, were all Pennsylvania Germans ethnically and religiously, were either Mennonite or Lutheran or German Reformed. So I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And although there are a lot of Mennonites in Lancaster County, they historically have never been the majority, always been sort of a small piece of a much larger Pennsylvania German population. So the German Reformed Church would have been the largest, and the Lutherans second largest. And it's actually pretty hard to find a Mennonite with deep Lancaster County roots that doesn't have Reformed or Reformed and Lutheran ancestry. I have no Amish ancestry, so far as I know. I've never been able to. I mean, I'm pretty sure I don't have any Amish ancestry, but Mennonite and Reformed and Lutheran. You know, religiously, I'm a member of a Mennonite church, have been since my like middle teen years or so, and have been involved in Mennonite churches, well, all the different places that my wife and I have lived. And she is a Mennonite pastor, and so I also have that kind of institutional connection via her. Another connection for me would be that I'm teaching at Elizabethtown College, which is a school related to the Church of the Brethren. And so that's one of the historic peace churches, along with Quakers and Mennonites. And the Church of the Brethren would have Anabaptist and Pietist roots. So that's getting to know the Brethren and Brethren history here through my role at the Young Center, and through the college here and the community and many of the supporters of the Young Center, has been another and a different and interesting window into another part of the contemporary Anabaptist world that is both similar in some ways to Mennonites, but also appropriately quite different and distinctive in its own way.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
My mom was a Church of the Brethren pastor for many years. I remember it being so much of going to a service there felt so familiar, but then other pieces, like their sort of anthem is "Move in Our Midst," versus like they're very into like the Spirit moving is sort of I remember. Also, just real briefly, I don't know if I fully know what Pietist means. So could you just give us the like 30-second definition?
Sure. So Pietism was a movement about a century and a half after the Protestant Reformation, primarily among Lutheran and Reformed churches, where certain Lutheran and Reformed folks like look around and say, wow, we've had, you know, 150 years of the Reformation and Europe is getting worse. This is not what we planned. This is not what was supposed to happen. And as they kind of diagnosed the problem, they said, we have spent too much time emphasizing, and some of this is their language and some of this is my paraphrase of it, but they said, we have spent an inordinate amount of time focusing on the head, which was their way of saying doctrine, and not enough on the heart and the hand, by which they meant devotion and service to others, so practical faith and devotion and attention to matters of the spirit and things like that. So Pietism was in some ways an effort to, from the Pietist perspective, to rebalance head, hand, and heart, and to, in some ways, to kind of decenter the hour-long doctrinal sermon as the center of what it meant to, you know, be church, and to folks. So Pietists were really into writing hymns. They were into renewing ritual. And you see this in traditions that emerge out of Pietism, often an emphasis on a complete love feast as part of communion. Anyway, other sorts of examples like that. What happens then after, you know, this is in the 1600s, later 1600s, and then Pietists in many places kind of run up against brick walls. There are, particularly in the Lutheran and Reformed state church traditions, there are vested interests in universities and theology departments and professional pastors and, you know, all sorts of vested interests. They really don't want things to change, that are happy with the focus being on the head and not the heart and the hand, or just don't want change or whatever. And so eventually there are a group of, and it's, you know, it's like with everything, it's a complicated story, but to sort of simplify, at a certain point, there are what are called radical Pietists who just get fed up with just kind of meeting all kinds of resistance as they try to bring Pietist renewal to the state churches, the Lutheran and Reformed state churches. And so they adopt an Anabaptist ecclesiology. So the radical Pietists take their Pietist agenda and wed it to an Anabaptist ecclesiology of the free church tradition, adult baptism, and generally non-resistance, other sorts of things. And so it's out of that tradition that today's Church of the Brethren and other Brethren groups would have emerged. So it's sort of a combination of a Pietist agenda that gets frustrated with the state church system and adopts an Anabaptist ecclesiology. So one of the reasons I think, for example, that you can feel something of a different flavor in many Brethren groups, even in a lot of old order Brethren groups, like old German Baptist Brethren, is that, you know, coming out of Pietism, the idea behind Pietism was that this was a renewal movement for like the whole church. And you see a little bit of that piece in Brethren groups in which they are not nearly as sectarian as Mennonites. Even mainline Mennonites tend to kind of think about like being Mennonite more so than being like ecumenical. And a lot of the Brethren groups, part of their Pietist background is to like be in conversation with all sorts of groups, just be like a somewhat less sectarian. It's a little hard to put your finger on it exactly. I'm not sure anyone would kind of say it that baldly, but that's one of the things that you notice, and it comes out of that Pietist background.
Interesting.
Yeah. And you'd see that then also in like sort of the Pietist emphasis on the renewal of worship. When they adopt Anabaptist adult baptism, their approach to baptism is one that takes symbolism pretty seriously in terms of immersion and triple immersion and you know, immersion in which the baptismal candidate goes forward into the water because we're baptized into the death of Christ. And, you know, scripture says, and Jesus hung his head and died. And so he's you're dying, you're sort of falling forward. And so anyway, there's just sort of like a lot of attention to ritual and symbolism and having an experience that you will remember, not just with words, but sort of bodily experience. So
how did you first become interested in researching Amish and Amish history? And what role has that research interest played within your broader career as a historian?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And I should probably have some kind of, I don't know, great answer. It's pretty prosaic. And growing up in Lancaster, I had Amish neighbors. And the Amish are just sort of part of the landscape. And in that sense, you know, not actually all that particularly interesting to me. In high school, I had a job at a visitor center, a Mennonite-related visitor center called The People's Place. And so that's probably where I first started kind of reading about Amish life and beliefs and history, because we got questions from visitors. And so, you know, it just kind of made sense to have some answers for them. Probably my introduction to kind of thinking about old order life in a serious and fairly sympathetic way actually came at Goshen. It came when I was a student at Goshen College. So I was an undergraduate student at Goshen College, and history professor Theron Schlabach, who was an important influence for me, was he had a not idealistic but a sympathetic view of old order groups. Kind of wanted to take them seriously and wanted to see them as part of the larger Mennonite and Anabaptist story. He did that with his work in the Mennonite Experience in America books, when not all the scholars who were involved in that series thought that really Amish or old order groups should really not even be a part of that series in quite the same way. But he really made a case that they should be. And so that was part of my important influence. And then after college, and there are a couple steps in between, but within a year or two after graduating from Goshen, I was back living in Lancaster and was hired for a year by Don Krabel, who I ended up then working with on a lot of projects through the years. But initially, this was just like a one-year thing. He got a grant. He had gotten a grant to study Amish businesses, like first-generation Amish folks who weren't farming and had started their own businesses. And so I spent a year going around interviewing Amish business people. And just sort of found that fascinating. Did not expect to really do anything with Amish studies thereafter. Learned a lot from Don in terms of scholarship and publishing and a variety of things, creating a research project and things like that. But didn't necessarily expect to, continue with Amish related things. But that kind of contemporary experience of interviewing Amish business people alongside some of the historical work that really took the old order perspective seriously from Theron Schlabach that I had just a couple years before are probably, pretty foundational. So, how that has then played into the rest of my career, after working on that Amish business project with Don Krabel, I went off to grad school in history and focused on immigration, ethnicity, and religion. Did not study Mennonites, did not study the Amish, actually looked at German Reformed and Lutheran churches and their process of and thinking about Americanization in the 19th century. Didn't really expect necessarily, had a personal interest in Mennonite history, had these great experiences with some Amish research things, but didn't necessarily expect that to be the future of anything that I would do academically. Finished grad school and ended up getting a job back at Goshen College, which was not something that I had expected or even ever would have thought was possible, just given the configuration of staffing at the time until just right before I was hired. And my hiring there coincided with Goshen College receiving a four-year grant from the Lilly Endowment, the folks at Lilly who are generous in funding all sorts of things in higher ed in Indiana. Someone at Lilly had discovered that, and I think they discovered this with some prompting from John Roth at Goshen. But anyway, they discovered that the Amish of Indiana had not been receiving their fair share of attention compared with the Amish of Ohio and Pennsylvania. And of course, this bothered people at Lilly who wanted to see Indiana have its, proper place in this scheme of things. So Goshen received this grant, and Tom Myers, who was a sociology professor there for many years, and I were hired to spend part of our contract years for 4 years traveling around Indiana and interviewing Amish people, documenting Amish history and contemporary life all over the state. We joked later we could have also written a companion book called Cheap Hotels of Southern Indiana, because that was part of the experience as well as we were traveling around. But after working on that project for 4 years, then you get to a point where like you work on something and that generates its own set of invitations. So to work on similar things. So since that time, I've been invited to work on a variety of Amish related projects, and I've enjoyed that. And that's been kind of this like parallel kind of theme for me. But really from, day to day, when I was teaching at Goshen, most of my teaching was on immigration and ethnicity, American history generally, but particularly immigration, ethnicity, and race. And then coming here to Elizabethtown, right now I'm teaching a class on colonial and revolutionary North America, or teach a class on immigration or that sort of thing. And my work at the Young Center includes work related to the Amish, but also a lot of things related to other Mennonite or Brethren groups. So I really enjoyed my work with the Amish. It's never actually really been my job, but it's been an important and fun stream that I've carried on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this kind of connects to that. How does your experience, and or maybe how did your experience in some of these as a Mennonite, both help and hinder building relationships or doing some of this research with Amish people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a great essay. I don't know, maybe did I assign this? You would have been a student. Actually, I shouldn't ask that because then it's going to like put you on the spot. But no, there was this great essay by Hasia Diner that I know I used to use in class. It actually appears in a book called Strangers at Home, which is a book about essays on Mennonite and Amish women's history. And there's the article by Hasia Diner, who's neither Amish nor Mennonite. She's a Jewish historian who There it is. Aaron's holding it up. Holding up the copy. I'm glad you had that book just handy. It's like we prepared or something. But
got my Mennonite bookshelf right behind me.
So Hasia Diner has this great essay called Insights and Blind Spots, in which she writes about being a Jewish historian of Judaism and a Jewish historian of Irish American experience. So her field is women's history, but like Jewish women, Irish women, Jewish American, Irish American women. And in this essay of insights and blind spots, which, I mean, the title sort of says it all, you know, there are things that you see that maybe others would miss. And then there's other things that you miss that are, you know, important. I mean, maybe to take it though a little bit, I don't know, deeper. I guess I would say I have over time come to recognize that there are more, use that language, more blind spots than I might have realized. And that's because I think just jump back to saying earlier, kind of my introduction to Amish history and so on through both Theron Schlaubach and through Don Krable, not necessarily history, but sociology, both of them working in what I would call like a neo-Anabaptist frame, meaning mid-20th century, the work of Harold Bender, John Hostetler, others coming out of World War II, had this sort of mental picture of a big tent of North American Mennonites, Brethren in Christ, Amish, Beachy Amish, sort of all these groups are under this big tent. They're all Anabaptists and their stories are similar, but in kind of different registers. And so the differences are important, but the differences in some ways, I don't want to say they're surface, but the differences are interesting and kind of secondary. The primary thing that, you know, is that they share a lot in common. John Hostetler, one of the earliest academics to study the Amish systematically, used to refer to Amish values simply as the Charter. And by that, he meant the Schleitheim Confession of 1527. And he had gotten that from Harold Bender, who was his professor. In fact, Hostetler dedicates his early work on the Amish to Harold Bender and uses that kind of mid-20th century big tent Anabaptist frame. And so that can, I think, encourage and did for me, encourage me as a Mennonite to think, oh, I kind of understand this story because the, you know, Amish people are maybe living out their faith in a different way than maybe a modern Mennonite or modern Brethren in Christ person or whoever. But, you know, really, we sort of do all understand each other. They're different, but they're sort of like the same story on one level, have the same story in sort of a different register. And it's become increasingly clear to me, and not just in the last 6 months, but like in the last 25 years, that, you know, when I'm talking with or visiting with Amish people, my story isn't just their story in a different register. It's not their story at all, or at least it hasn't been for a very long time. And my being Mennonite does not connect with or really matter to most of them. And so I could give maybe more examples about that, but I've become increasingly aware that my mental frame of this sort of big tent of Anabaptist group is not a mental image that most Amish people share.
Like your big tent, that using that phrase and that way of viewing things, I think resonated with, in some ways, like growing up as a Mennonite, what I was kind of taught, like, oh, Amish are kind of just like us, but have made some slightly different choices kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And to really realize that it might be different than that. So go ahead.
I was gonna say, I mean, you can see this, an academic way, like, I mean, this is a really sort of niche example but you guys would understand. It's like, who did Harold Bender include in the Mennonite Encyclopedia? I mean, like that's one way of sort of imagining this. Like, not everybody gets included in that, but certain people do, right? So who gets it? Anyway, that's you know, be one sort of example. I think one of the other reasons that it was possible for a period of time in the mid-20th century to imagine that big tent was that it wasn't always imagined. There was a period of time from a generation or two after roughly World War II that there were a fair number of Amish reared people in Mennonite churches, like people who had grown up Amish who became Mennonite, right? That's less and less common today for a number of reasons. One, retention rates are higher among Old Order groups. Second, the Amish population dispersion across North America, lots and lots and lots of Amish communities are not in any geographic proximity to Mennonites. And as Mennonites are also sort of urbanizing, they're living in places where they don't have a lot of interaction with Amish people other than maybe as tourists themselves, right? So, at one point, a lot of Amish and Mennonite communities kind of overlap geographically, and those communities still exist. Northern Indiana would be one of those. Mm-hmm. But those are not where the bulk of either Amish or Mennonites live now. So, you know, an Amish person who's leaving the Amish community is not apt to, you know, connect with Mennonites because that's not who they're living around. That's just one example. But I mean, I think it also has to do with, I mean, I would say it's sort of this is a kind of blind spot. It's actually more of an assumption, an example. I mean, it creates a blind spot, but it's assumptions in which, if I assume that I understand, you know, this group, in this case, the Amish, and I see, and I try to interpret what they're doing in my lens. And I heard this from my teachers and from people a generation older than me who had a sympathetic view of the Amish. I mean, there were people older than me who are Mennonites who had a very unsympathetic view of the Amish, you know, who like to, you know, play the game. Let's compare my highest ideals with your worst examples. And I mean, that's a different issue, which maybe we'll talk about later. But for those who had sort of a sympathetic view of the Amish, they would say, like, the Amish are just astute sociologists, really. You know, they take, you know, a new item of technology and they examine it and they say, how will this, you know, impact our community? Will it accentuate individualism? Is it gonna, you know, replace Gemeinschaft with Gesellschaft and, you know, and so on and so forth? And you know, that's not totally wrong. I mean, that is one way to understand some Amish community discussions and decision making. And there is a connection between, say, to use this example, technology and community. But it's often different when you really sort of get down to it and you talk to Amish people, particularly in the more conservative groups, but not, I mean, the more traditionalist Amish affiliations, but even sort of across the board. You know, the logic is more often like this, like, well, If we accept technology X, then we're going to be out of fellowship with church Y, and then who will our children marry? Okay, we can't accept, you know, technology X, right? So that's a connection between technology and community and prioritizing the community, but it's very different than sort of a mainline Mennonite individualism versus communitarianism framing of things. And so if I come in thinking that they're thinking about their decisions in the way I'm thinking about it, and they're just making a different decision, like they're choosing the horse and buggy instead of the car. So we've made a different decision, but we're sort of fundamentally thinking about it in the same way. I'm not really understanding them because they're not thinking about it in the same way.
Hmm. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, this next question, it really follows right up with that. Because one thing we see a lot in our, we have a trope tracker where we track tropes that we see in the media we cover. And one of the things we see a lot, I think we call it, Amish do-gooder or something like that, where it's like this perfect character that can do nothing wrong. We've also seen one of our even more popular tropes that we track is like corruption of the pure. So there's this like dichotomy. There's like the Amish portrayed as perfect creatures that can do nothing wrong. And you'd never think that they were the ones who could have possibly committed the crime in the book or whatever. But then there's also often it seems like the joy of seeing the pious fall. How do you capture the full picture of the Amish when you're studying them?
So there's a great book by Dave Weaver-Zerker called The Amish in the American Imagination, copyright 2001. Shout out there to Dave. His thesis is that the othering of the Amish is, you know, in some ways not unlike all sorts of othering that we might see in society, but the othering of the Amish is a phenomenon in which the social images of the Amish toggle between these two extremes. As you just said, they're either sort of too good to be true or, you know, so bad it's almost unbelievable. And it just kind of goes back and forth between those two extremes. And I find one of the aspects of my job here at the Young Center is fielding media questions, often from reporters, but also questions from people working in government agencies, questions from researchers, questions from high school students. Anyway, there's just like a lot of questions that come in here. And so part of what I sometimes try to do is figure out if there is, you know, where the question's coming from, because there are questions that are predicated on the Amish being too good to be true. And, you know, part of my answer then is to kind of push the frame a little, you know, towards the middle. And then there are also questions in which, you know, the Amish are just terrible people. And so part of my answer to the question is like kind of trying to push those people a little more to the middle, because certainly there are lots of individual and familial and social problems and issues in Amish society. And they're also like really positive and good things, right? And like with any community. And so, you know, ideally you'd like to be able to, you know, if you had a community that really was genuinely unknown, you might be able to sort of start from like, I don't know, zero and try to paint a picture that included both. But when we're dealing with the Amish are so well known, doesn't mean that they're actually accurately well known, but they're so well known that the questions about the Amish kind of come with a kind of baked in sense of who the Amish are. And so it might be a factual question, but the factual question is sitting on top of an understanding of the Amish that's usually either, again, too good to be true or like so bad it's unbelievable. So one of the things that I find interesting is that, like in listening to your podcast, which I do, particularly in the early seasons when you were reading more, you know, novels, romance novels and things, to hearing how many positive images, which again, I knew from, you know, just know in general, and Dave Weaver-Zirker in his book talks about this, that's certainly one of the things. Where I sit, like sort of fielding questions that come in about the Amish, actually a lot of the questions that come in are start from a pretty negative view of the Amish. So one of the things that it's a problem for me is that how, you know, when I get all these questions from people who are highly skeptical at best that, you know, that the Amish in some cases should even be allowed to exist. You know, their questions like why do we as society even allow people to live like this or whatever? Sometimes they're not that bald, but often they are. Is to, you know, I find myself sometimes answering those factual questions with sort of adding in, you know, the sort of like push to the center. And then I wonder, like, am I contributing to some sort of idealization of the Amish? I mean, am I painting too positive a picture? Because I'm trying to counter this really negative image that's there as well. And but it is something that I think about. It's like how to, you know, if it was just like presenting factual answers to questions, and that is, you know, in the end of the day, that's what I'm trying to do. But, you know, no one's objective, including me, and you're trying to, you know, you want to think who is the audience, like what's going to be most helpful here in terms of an answer, and like think about the audience, and then of course think about myself, think about my own positionality, and think about who's the audience. And because I get a lot of questions for whom the audience are highly skeptical of the Amish, I do find myself often presenting a response that tries to, you know, call that into question. So I guess that's kind of a long way of saying that I don't want to offer overly positive or like rosy image of the Amish. So what I try to do is to gently, or maybe sometimes not so gently, actually just question the negative assumptions that are built in. Because I don't think it's, you know, it's just to try to sort of counter those with like a really positive picture is going to create a different problem, or sort of puts me in a situation that I don't necessarily want to be quoted in, or I don't want to contribute to this overly positive image either. Mm-hmm. But I do find myself often kind of asking questioners to themselves question where their negative bias is coming from.
Well, just I'm fascinated that the questions you get are coming from a negative place, because that is pretty counter to what we see portrayed in. I mean, I guess the people asking the questions are probably very, like, we're consuming media mostly done by, like, evangelicals who I think have this idealized view. And I guess you're fielding questions from, I don't know, who, reporters?
and I should be clear, yeah. You know, not all the questions are negative, but, you know, questions that come from government officials or come from journalists are usually questions that are, you know, prompted by some sort of conflict. Right.
That makes sense.
So that's, you know, there's some sort of conflict somewhere. And wouldn't it just be easier if the Amish weren't so different? You know, if they were just more like the rest of us, wouldn't have this conflict.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is interesting the way in which I think liberal pluralism celebrates pluralism that comes from a place of individual choice, and pluralism that comes out of individuals making divergent choices about their how to live and their own individual lives. And when you have a community, when you have a sort of different community or diversity coming from different communal groups, it's a little harder for even people who want to celebrate pluralism to kind of get kind of really get behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely something we've seen in depictions where it's like they take Amish who, you know, and they tell like very individualized stories in they strip away like the family and the community, and they just tell this individual story because that's the frame that makes sense to them. But this idea of taking that apart, and, you know, it distorts a lot of, you know, those Amish values. And I was also going to say, I wonder, and too, there's an element of, like, we've definitely seen with our depictions, there's this overall, at least, you know, we have not consumed nearly every piece of media that connects to Amish. Yeah. It'd be a long and very boring podcast, I think. But in some ways, like, other people are also like seeing these, like, so much of it is positive in terms of, like, there is some, not all of it is, but so much of it is positive. And so other members of society who maybe don't have as much, like, if that's your sole knowledge, in some ways having that kind of, well, you know, why would I believe that? Like, oh, goody two shoes, like, in some ways, like a reaction to, if that depiction is so positive, then maybe there's an element of, oh, well, I'm just going to assume that that's false and they must be not as great as all of that or something. Like pushing
right.
back
yeah.
with that.
Yeah. And again, that's sort of part of Dave's argument is that, you know, when you have a depiction that's so idealized, the only, well, not the only, but the way to make sense of the first time you see a flaw or find a flaw is to think that, you know, the whole thing is hypocritical. Right. And so then you like flip to the other extreme.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a particularly interesting, like a random question or a tidbit of like the most interesting question that you've had to respond to?
So, for example, I got a question here, I don't know, within the last few years from, I'll say, a major research hospital, teaching hospital that had to do some emergency surgery on an Amish person who had been in an accident and ended up having to amputate his arm. And after it was, as the surgery is concluding, the surgeon all of a sudden has this memory somewhere that he had read or heard that Amish people need to be sort of buried when they die as whole people. And so that this man is going to want his arm. And so how can they like preserve it to give it back to him? And there was a nurse in the surgical ward who thought, this is not true. Like, this can't be true. And so at a certain point in the surgery, she had someone call the Young Center. And I was like, no, you don't have to give the arm back to the guy. He doesn't really want it. Right. It's not. And she said, okay, well, cause the surgeon thinks that it's an important part of their religion that they need all their body parts. And I was like, well, I don't think so, but yeah, I don't. Yeah. So it's an example of where, I mean, so there's a question that's really a bizarre example, but it's a question of where people think they know about the Amish. And it comes from, like, that particular question, like, comes from a good place, like, as in not wanting to do the wrong thing, right? So there's been some interesting research around. There was a nurse practitioner here in Lancaster who did her nurse practitioner thesis on Amish vaccination, rates of vaccination, immunization of, and the number one reason that unimmunized Amish people gave for not being immunized, it wasn't the majority, but it was the plurality, it was the biggest answer, was that no family doctor had ever offered immunization, right? And so then she starts interviewing other doctors, and they all say, like, oh, no, it's against their religion, so I would be offensive for me to offer immunization. Well, that's not true. But you have, but again, people think they know the Amish. And so they are trying to respond appropriately. So, but they're examples of the range of things that, and those are, it would be examples of, like, sort of, I would say, questions that are really coming from a positive place, even if there's a misunderstanding. So those aren't examples of questions that are kind of coming with an embedded negative bias, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Something else I was involved with, some research with a political science colleague here and some folks from a neighboring college doing a survey on, among other things, attitudes about the Amish. More complex than that, but a couple of the questions feature on. And these were just people in Lancaster County. That was just the scope that we were looking at. And so the question was, some of the questions were like, what's your view of the, it was sort of a feeling thermometer, you know, from plus 100 to minus 100 or something, you know, your attitudes with the Amish. And then later there was a question about how much interaction you actually have with Amish people. So interestingly, people who interact with Amish people on at least a monthly basis all had very positive images of the positive impressions of the Amish. Like if you know Amish people, you generally have a positive impression. For people who didn't have regular interaction with the Amish, they were divided. And then we were trying to figure out, like, kind of what the different demographics were behind this divide. But that was kind of what we were looking at. But yeah, either quite negative views or really, really positive. I mean, it kind of fit into this thing again that, I mean, people who interacted with the Amish didn't just have a neutral view. They did have a positive view, but it was different than the people who didn't have interactions, who either had a negative view or a really positive view. So it's kind of interesting kind of survey responses that kind of confirmed what I think I've just noticed anecdotally.
So this is still in the topic of research and approaching things. And one thing we've thought about, talked about, discussed a lot as a podcast is, you know, we're covering the Amish. We're talking, well, like even our podcast name, which is a pun I'm very proud of, still says just plain wrong. We are not plain ourselves. And we've wrestled a lot with that. You know, you might not necessarily call yourself an Amish expert, but that is sort of a role that at least the media and some government officials and at least one nurse at a research hospital have decided to give you. So how do you balance your role in answering these questions and writing these books on the Amish with the fact that you are not personally from that group?
So two answers. And the first one is that it doesn't bother me. And then I need to qualify or say why it doesn't. And then the second answer is that it does bother me. Okay. So why doesn't it bother me? It doesn't bother me because I'm a historian. And so I would say more about that. I mean, as historians, we believe that everyone's identity you know, has all these component parts. But as historians, we think that your location in time is really important. I mean, race and gender and ethnicity and sexuality, and like all these things are important, but also your place in time is important. And as a historian, we are looking at people who we can never fully identify with, right? So someone who lived in 1724, that piece of their identity that is living in 1724 is not something that I can ever access living in 2024, right? So as historians, we are always dealing with people who we are not, because there's no one living around here now from 1724, right? They're all dead. And so we're always looking and trying to understand people who, like, there's no one living today who could say, that's my experience, right? In the way that we could say, like, well, okay, I'm going to do women's history. That's not my experience as, you know, as a man or whatever. You know, we could use a variety of examples, right? But there's nobody, no historian who can say, that's my experience that is living in 1724. So on one level, historians have to come to terms with or be comfortable with trying to interpret the lives of people who they are not. Otherwise, we wouldn't get up in the morning. So I don't start there to sort of like be flip and then say, you know, so it doesn't matter that, you know, my identity is different from what. But at a certain point, the fact that I'm not Amish, but I'm trying to understand and interpret the lives of Amish people is something that as a historian does not feel strange to me. At the same time, whether I'm dealing with someone who lived in 1724 or an Amish person in 2024, it does bother me because it's really difficult to think about interpreting anyone else's experience. And we get it wrong so often. And so that's not maybe a very satisfying answer to your question, other than to say that I'm just aware that it is it's a very real tension. So on the one hand, I don't think there's anything at all wrong with you guys doing the podcast with the topic and scope that you're doing. And I don't think that's a problem. But, you know, for myself and for you, I think it's a challenge. And I don't know that there's an easy way out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I call myself a librarian more than a historian, but that definitely, you know, my background was in history, and that, yeah, it just really rings true, this idea of, you know, interpreting, like, you are always interpreting across difference. Like, you can't write a history unless it's an autobiography that matches your own experience completely. Yeah. In some ways, this next question is a bit of a turn, and in some ways it kind of connects. We'll see how it goes. But so in some ways, talking about that idea of experience and maybe looking more broadly at, you know, your career, how would you say, and you can feel free to interpret this as broadly or as specifically as you would like, how has your Mennonite experience kind of influenced your identity as a historian? How would you connect the two?
Yeah, this was a question you sent me in advance, and I thought this is a really good question that I could think about for a long time. I mean, I'll just tell you that one of the first things that came to mind, and then I'll be self-critical of that answer. The first thing that came to mind is that as a Mennonite, I don't have an experience of seeing myself represented in very many history books. I mean, unless they're like written like about Mennonites, right? Like, Mennonites are just a really small group and a relatively inconsequential group, unless you're looking at, I don't know, certain very specific fields or topics. And so unlike, say, a smaller group like the, you know, a numerically smaller group like the Quakers, right? Like, Quakers show up in all kinds of, you know, run-of-the-mill high school history textbooks and so on. And in other academic circles, right? There's whole PhD programs in Quaker studies, and I don't think there is such a thing. I mean, people do PhDs in Mennonite history, but there are no like dedicated programs linked to that. So, I mean, I could be, it can be critical. I mean, self-critical of that and say, well, you know, Steve, there's also, there's, you're more than just Mennonite. So there's plenty of times you've seen yourself represented as, you know, upper middle class white man. So English speaker, citizen, whatever. I mean, could go on. But since your question was about being a Mennonite, that's why I'm going to focus on that piece. So I think in that sense, as being a connection, being a historian, and there's probably more profound ways to answer this question, but is to, the connection is being, is expecting that there are a lot of untold stories out there and to be alert to those, try to be alert to those. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that that's one of the ways that it has shaped me. And in a different but kind of related way, I would say that's one of the things that I feel like I benefited from my experience or interaction with Amish folks. There are lots of groups that could have provided for me what the Amish do. But in my case, it's the Amish who've most often done that. And that is to be a people who are more or less living in the same community, same geographic space as me, but are experiencing it differently and are thinking about it differently, are interpreting it differently, are treated differently than I am in the same space. And so as a person whose identity carries a lot of privilege, it's easy for me to assume that my experience of the world is, you know, fairly typical. And we, you know, we have big words for that of, you know, solipsism and essentializing the self and so on and so on. For me, as someone who's ensconced in higher education and have been now for decades, like it's really important for me, it's been important for me to regularly interact with people who don't go to high school, don't go to college, and have very good lives and don't necessarily seem to be missing much. Right. And now, again, we could go on about like, well, what about there? You know, there are some Amish people who, you know, wish they could pursue higher education or leave the Amish to do so. OK, so that's not the point of that. I mean, the point for me in this case is to regularly be interacting with people who are experiencing the world differently from me and to take that seriously. And just use education as an example, because it's something, again, that I'm pretty invested in. And then I'm regularly interacting with people for whom, you know, it's not important. And so, again, there are a variety of groups, cultures, social classes who could teach me those same lessons. But it has been the Amish who have most consistently done that for me.
I really like that answer. Yeah. So I think it sort of does that for, I mean, I feel like through this podcast, we're having a kind of similar-ish, I mean, we don't work directly with the Amish, but I feel like we're learning a lot about, I just feel like we're learning similar things about ourselves and about the Amish through doing this mm-hmm. podcast. Yeah. Anyway, our final question is, yeah. So what are you working on now? Are you researching, are you working on a book? Are you researching anything in particular, in your free time these days?
Well, related to the Amish, I was working on, and sort of still am working on a project with a colleague here in political science. We were looking at the efforts to mobilize the Amish politically in terms of as voters. Mm-hmm. That project got put on hold because of COVID. We weren't out doing field work around the 2020 election, for example. And then there's just been some other things in terms of other work that he's been doing and some other things that I'm doing with now my administrative role here as Young Center Director. So we want to get back to that project, but that's kind of on hold. We worked on it for about 4 or 5 years and do want to get back to that. I'm also working on drafting some finishing up a few chapters, 3 or 4 chapters on a book about Mennonites in Virginia, and working on that with Elwood Yoder, who's working on other chapters of that. And then the Young Center, this isn't research, but it's a project that takes some time. The Young Center is plans to host a little more than a year from now, 15 months from now or so, July of 2025, an academic conference on Anabaptism, particularly 16th and 17th centuries. So that's something that we'll be hosting here. And so there's a certain amount of legwork that, again, this point in the semester, for me, we're recording this in April, is really sort of back burner as we hurtle towards finals and commencement. Yeah. But once we get through that, get back to working on planning that that conference.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much, Steve. This was such a interesting conversation and just, mm-hmm. yeah, so grateful that you were willing to come on and talk to us. So
yeah, very, well, very thanks. Grateful. Thanks for the invitation, because mm-hmm. I do listen to the podcast. So,
well, that's awesome. Well,
we received more than one corrections email.
Okay, that's
which, to be fair, we always appreciate. We take it seriously. Oh, yes, we say we want corrections. We say it and we mean it, and we appreciate when we get them.
I did notice the episode that was posted unedited. And I did, but I didn't write to you about that. I was like, I'm driving to work and I'm thinking, I wonder if they put the raw footage on. And, but then I was like, okay, well, I don't know. Anyway. And then like the next one. So.
Well, now we know definitively. We're kind of wondering like who listened to that or how many people did or. Anyways,
it wasn't bad. It was just, it wasn't like, what I mean is it wasn't like you guys said anything embarrassing. It was just like, not the usual quality that we've come to expect.
So our embarrassing moment as a podcast mostly me, it was my fault, but.
Oh, we all shared in it. You I don't know. I think you probably feel the most, anyways, you probably feel the worst about it, but All right. Well, thank you for listening to this week's interview with Steve Nolte. We'd love to hear your thoughts on othering the Amish or research stories, as well as recommendations, corrections, and other musings.
Next week, we'll be discussing the Enneagram with a special guest, Marathona Prothro from Bluffton University.
You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram at PlainWrongPod, or email us at PlainWrongPod@gmail.com. If you'd like to help support the podcast financially, we have merch for sale at TeePublic and a Patreon you can join. And we also always appreciate when people leave reviews and subscribe, as that is how other people learn this podcast exists. Thanks for tuning in.